Sunday, you realize that this is the 10th lesson, and there's not but 24 of them. So we are fast moving through this section. It's kind of unusual to have 24 this quarter, but that's how many we'll have. So anyway, as Joshua talked to the children of Israel, Moses talked to the children of Israel, and that one of the things that was said was, do not forsake the Lord and go after strange gods. That was one thing that was said over and over again. And countless times, the children of Israel said what, number one? We will do what God says. That's right. Thank you. We will do what God says. Children of Israel said that over and over and over again. And now we find exactly what's happening. The children of Israel forsook the Lord. They served Balaam and Asherah. And this is Baal's counterpart, more or less. God sold them into the hands of Cushan-Rishathaim, from Mesopotamia, and we find that in the third chapter in verse 7. Remember that what Joshua told them was going to happen, and this is exactly what is taking place right now. God is turning them over to heathen lands, and we're going to find out a little bit more about that as well. Cushan-Rishathaim translated, or rather interpreted, man of Cush. He is of the twofold crime, more or less. And the King James Version lists him as Cushan-Rishathaim. He's mentioned in Judges, the third chapter, verse 8 through 10, as the king of Mesopotamia, who was chosen by God as his tool to do something. What was it? There it is. What did he do? What was he going to use him for? It's pointed out right there. Chastise Israel. Why would Israel need chastising, number two? They had forsaken God. Exactly right. And God said that's what he's going to do. So he chastised them, the Israelites, for their idolatry. After Joshua's death, the children of Israel soon began to affiliate themselves with the heathen people who dwelt among them. And this was a fertile resource, you might say, being involved with them, intermarrying, those kind of things took place, and God was just couldn't put up with it anymore. So he sent Cushan-Rishathaim to correct them, try to get them to do what was right again. Barring this short passage in Judges about Cushan-Rishathaim, there's not a whole lot said about him. But we do know that he was used to chastise Israel. 8 years the Israelites were under his dominion. And the Lord raised up a deliverer to them, and his name was Othniel. That's the first judge, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. He was the first judge. Israel cried to the Lord. He raised up a savior, and the spirit of the Lord came upon Othniel, and he defeated Cushan-Rishathaim. We usually think of a time of war in Israel during the time of Judges, that there was war everywhere. However, it was not war throughout the land. This was just in given locations. And this just happened to be one of them. There was some overlapping of the judges, even, who judged at the same time another judge actually judged. And we don't really have an account of who that is. I don't remember if we do. Maybe Jimmy bring it up, but I don't remember who overlapped. But there was a period of time would dictate that more or less. After a victory by Israel, there would be peace for many years when one of these nations would come against them and they would fight against them, and then they would have peace for a number of years. Well, why would it be important to control Israel? Why do you think it was necessary to have Israel, the land of Israel? Well, the reason is because there are some major trade routes. You can't go across here. Why? That's the desert. You can't go across there. Well, it's tough if you're over in this area to get produce or any kind of thing that you're selling down into this region down in here. Hard to do that unless you come through the land of Canaan. And there are some major trade routes that go through that. And I'm going to show you that right now. And if you'll look real close at those dots, it'll show you that route that they go from Mesopotamia. There's a couple of them, so watch closely at the dot. Now you see that? Now, if you blinked your eyes, you missed it. But that kind of gives you an idea where one of those trade routes was, and there's the other one. And it went down to the land of Egypt. And, of course, you got the river Euphrates, and the Tigris rivers are up in that region right there, and they go down through Mesopotamia. Well, where'd I go? Hit the wrong button. There we go. All right. So we find that now we have Othniel living in the central area of Canaan. Central to southern area of Canaan, of Judah. Othniel may have met Cush and Rish and Thaim as his army came to conquer some of the cities in Canaan. We're not sure exactly where they met or where the war was. We just know that Othniel won the battle. We're not given a lot of that. But Jehovah delivered him into the hand of Othniel. This is kind of an idea about the region where Othniel did most of his work and so forth in the land of Israel. Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, and so he sent Eglon. And Eglon is king of the Moabites. Moab is located where? Number three. Where's Moab located? I've lost number three. Number three. Where is Moab? Southeast. Okay. It's on the eastern border of the Jordan and the Dead Sea. It's right east of the Dead Sea there. Good. All right. So, Eglon is king of the Moabites along with the Amorites and the Amalekites. They all got together and they came against Israel. They seized the city of palm trees. And that was the site of Old Jericho. Well, what does that tell you about that city? It kind of brought something to my mind as I was thinking about palm trees. What do you think of when you think of palm trees? Number one, warm climate. Yeah, good. That's exactly right. We see those along the Gulf, you know, palm trees and those kind of things, where the temperature is warm. So you mean Jericho was warm? Yeah, it was. It was a warm place, evidently, for the palm trees to be able to grow. Well, Israel served Eglon for 18 years. And during that particular time, many of the Moabites actually moved to the west side of Jordan. And you remember who Moab and Ammon is, don't you, number two? Moab and Ammon, you know who that is? Lot. All right. We won't hold that against you. Descendants of Lot by who? His two daughters. Very good. All right. All right. So, the Amalekites were one of the tribes from the desert, if you remember, that actually came against Israel at the place called, what? I'm good at that. What was the name of that place? Right there. There it is. Rephidim. What did they do at Rephidim, number one? I know they came against Israel, but what basically did they do that God just detested? Well, yeah, that's true, but I'm thinking, what did they do as far as the war against Israel? Anybody remember number two? Well, that's true, but that's not exactly why they came against them and what God detested about them coming against Israel at that time. I got everybody stumped on that one, I think. If you remember, Joshua was told to go and fight them. And the reason was because they had attacked the rear of the Israelites, those who were old and slow and the very ones that couldn't fight back, you might say. And God was, he detested that they did that kind of thing to his people. And so that's why they show up again here, because they lived in the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula at that time, and they made an alliance with Moab on the eastern plateau. The children of Israel cried out to Jehovah for deliverance again, and, of course, Jehovah sends Ehud of the tribe of Benjamin to save Israel. Ehud was one by whom Israel was sending their tribute to Eglon. What does it mean to send tribute, number two? What does it mean to send tribute? We call them taxes today, don't we? He taxed them right really hard. And so they actually sent a carrier to carry this tribute money, or taxes, if you want to call it that, to Eglon. And they would pay him on a regular basis, so he wouldn't come in and whip up on them, if you want to put it that way. So Ehud was one of them that was chosen to carry the tribute to Eglon. Ehud was a little different. I'm not saying all left-handed people are odd, but it was different over there. And there were several, and Jimmy mentioned some that were very good. They could hit, they could split a hair with a throwing the, now I know we got people that's good at throwing, you know, they can throw baseballs, that kind of thing. They're pretty good, that left hand. As far as I'm concerned, there ain't no way. I just couldn't do it. I look awkward even trying to throw with it, you know, but he was not one of those. He was very good with his left hand. And so Ehud made himself a double-edged sword about 18 inches long. That'd be about a cubit, okay? And he had prepared to take a tribute to Eglon, and he strapped his sword to his right side. Well, normally if you're right-handed, you would put your sword on the, what's that? The left side. Because you pull it out this way to use it. On the left side. So, it kind of left him in a position where, I don't know if they didn't pat him down that great back then, evidently. Because, I don't think you'd get away with that today going through on these metal detectors. So, anyway, normally a man would wear it on the left and draw it with his right hand. Ehud's sword, would not be as noticeable that way as a person who was right-handed. And so, after giving the tribute to the king, after he and the others, and he started back home. And after he'd gone a ways, wow, I hit the wrong button. I'm sorry. After he had gone away, he turned back at the stone quarry near Gilgal. That's the first that I've heard that there was a stone quarry at Gilgal. But evidently there was. And this is a place where Ehud turned back to go back to see Eglon just a little bit longer. And he had a secret message for him. Yeah, I'm going to tell you a secret, Mr. Eglon. And so when the king heard that he had a secret, he said, shh, I don't want anybody else to hear. I don't want anybody else to hear that. Shh. Wait a minute. Y'all, all you guys, all the attendants, y'all all get out. This man, he didn't say he was going to give me a secret, did he? He said, y'all get out. And so that leaves just Eglon and Ehud in the chambers there where they were in the upper room, in the cool upper room, it says, is where Ehud actually met him, in a cool upper room. Eglon was a, they would call him fat, sorry, hefty, pleasantly plump. I guess there's several words you could use, but he was literally, the Bible says he was a fat man. And so, Ehud said, I have a message from God. And so as he was ready to give him the message, he reached down with his left hand to his right side and pulled that sword out and stuck it in Eglon, killing him. And, just to give you an idea, an 18-inch long sword completely buried up inside him. So he's, I don't know if I could get an 18-inch one from me or not, but he was pretty hefty, evidently. And so it completely closed up, around him. Ehud then left it there and he went out of the room by the porch. In other words, he didn't go out by the same door he come in. He was determined to get away. So he left out by the porch. He locked the doors and he fled. So he went out a different door where the attendants that attend to Eglon normally don't come in, evidently. And so, they waited and waited and waited, and Eglon never did open the door. They saw it was locked, and they thought that he had, what does the scripture say? Anybody remember? What's the scripture say he did? Covered his feet. Used the restroom is the word for that. And he would do that in private, of course. And, they thought that's what he was doing. But, you know, he just kept on and on and on. And it just took, seemed like forever for that to take place. So during that particular time, Ehud made his way all the way back to the country of Ephraim. Now, from Moab to Ephraim Anybody got an idea about how far that might be? What would he have to do to get from Moab to Ephraim? He's going to have to cross the Jordan. Yeah, he's going to have to cross the Jordan. And there is a ford just above the Dead Sea there where somebody crossed. Who crossed there? The Israelites crossed there, didn't they? Yeah. And so there's a ford in that particular region right there. So he goes across the Jordan. Does he go north or south to get to Ephraim? Number one. Does he go north or south when he crosses the Jordan? Come on. Don't take all day to say north or south. Which way is it from Ephraim, from the top of the Dead Sea, to Ephraim? North. Good. Very good. Thank you. It's north. Okay. So, he goes north, and when he gets there, he does something. He blew a trumpet. What were we told back in, I guess that'd been Exodus and Leviticus, what a trumpet was used for? Three, what was the trumpet used for? What? Thank you. Call an assembly. That's right. Call for war. Call for whatever. Get the people together. And that's what had to take place. And, he told them to follow him because Jehovah had delivered Moab into your hands. Israel had killed every Moabite they came in contact with as they crossed the Jordan. About 10,000 of them that they killed. And Israel had rest for about 80 years, I'm sorry. So, in the days of Ehud and the oppression, we find that Moab, the Amorites, Amalekites, and then we find that Moab, some of them actually had moved over to the west side of the Dead Sea as well. So those are the ones that actually came against the Israelites. After Ehud, we find that Shamgar actually came on the scene. He was the son of Anath. He killed 600 men of the Philistines with an ox goad. How many have ever used an ox goad? Only one I could think of would be you, Brother Lawrence. No. An ox goad is something that's so long and it's pointed on one end, and when an ox wouldn't go, you would give him an incentive. No. Ox goad. And that's what it was. And they would punch the ox if they got kind of lazy on their plowing or whatever it was. Or if the man saw the rain cloud coming, he'd say, let's go, man. And that ox goad would make them go if they were pulling a cart or whatever it might be. But he used that to kill 600 Philistines. Nothing else is told us about Shamgar. When did he live? I don't know. What was the circumstances that caused him to do this? I don't know. Deborah actually refers to him in the song that she writes in Judges the 5th chapter. But she also states with that the caravan ceased during that time. So, I don't know. I can't give you any more information than that because I don't know it. So, but Shamgar brought relief to Israel. He did not have total deliverance from the Philistines at this time. Deborah indicates that the situation of danger in Shamgar's day was not completely alleviated until her time as judge. And even then, her tenure as judge was really related more to Ehud than it was to actually to Shamgar. And this is the first time that we have record of problems with the Philistines. They were not mentioned as one of the countries or nations that Israel, that God mentioned to the Israelites that they would have problems with. There had been Philistines in the land since the days of Abraham, Genesis the 20th chapter, if you remember. And even in when they left Egypt, if you remember in Exodus 13, as they were leaving, they did not go through the land of where? What land did they not go through? Because they weren't ready for war. The Philistines. They got, that would have been a shortcut if you think about it. And we'll see that in just a minute. The Philistines were not named as a major threat by Moses back in Deuteronomy. They were of the same bloodline as the Canaanites, the Egyptians. They were all descendants of Ham. Who was Ham? Noah's son. Good. That's right. Noah's son. And so after the victory of Shamgar, more of the Philistines probably settled in the area of Crete. That's a little island just off of the in the Mediterranean. But the Philistines are named as one of the people that God left for a reason. To test the Israelites. See if they would follow him or not. Okay? Do we have tests today? Yes, we do, don't we? And they had tests then, and they have them later on. As Rob was saying, the Philistines fought for control of the whole southern part of the land, and they were not subdued until the days of David, actually, in 2 Samuel, the 5th chapter. And then they were just subject for a brief period of time. That's right. Yep. Jimmy brings out the fact that they had iron chariots back earlier, and they Judah didn't drive them out because of the iron chariot. And now we're reaping the whirlwind, you might say. Okay, so this is the area of the Philistines. And if you'll think about it just briefly, if they left Egypt and they went right up through the Philistine territory, that would have been a shortcut compared to what they went through to get to the land of Canaan. But they weren't ready for war, and God knew that. They had been slaves. They didn't have weapons. I mean, so he told them to go into the bottom of the land, and he would drive out the inhabitants thereof. Well, that didn't work out, as we all know. So Israel turns from God again, and he sends Jabin, king of Canaan, against the captain. His captain's name was Sisera. Jabin reigned in Hazor, and Sisera was in the Harosheth Golan. The oppression was severe because they had 900 chariots of iron. It brings back Philistine problems with chariots of iron. They had a lot of chariots. Jabin ruled 20 years with the hand of iron, and Israel cried out to Jehovah for help. And we find that the Hazor is right up in this area, right up here. And Harosheth Goan is in this region right here. The Jezreel Valley is going to come into play in just a few minutes. And the Jezreel Valley runs from the Mount Carmel, which is that little point, all the way down to the, basically to the Jordan River. The oppression of the Canaanite, from the Canaanites, the people who Israel had already subdued earlier, many years have passed in Joshua's day, and now there is a king who rules over the Canaanites in Hazor, whose name is Jabin. This will be the last time that the Canaanites will be a threat to Israel. Their gods bring a downfall, or brought to a downfall by Israel, more or less. You notice that Hazor is near Lake Hula. Jabin, the chief captain, is Sisera, and Sisera is near Harosheth Golan, as I showed you a while ago. It may be termed for a wooded mountainous area up in that region. The oppression was primarily against the tribes in the north. Notice that. This was not against Judah. This was primarily against tribes in the north. And that's kind of the region right there where this is all taking place. So we find that Deborah comes onto the scene now, the judge. And Deborah was married to Lapidoth. Kind of a strange name. If somebody had mentioned Lapidoth, would you have known who he was? You know, it's just not a normal name, and we don't mention him a whole lot in Bible history. But Lapidoth, he's a man, he's not well known. He lived beneath the palm trees between Ramah and Bethel. Children of Israel came to her and for judgment, and she lived miles from the area that was actually being afflicted. So we find this is the area where Deborah and Lapidoth actually live. What else is in that region? What other city we just talked about that had palms? Jericho. All right, good. Jericho. All right, so we find that soldiers were called from Naphtali, Zebulun, to help, along with some of the other tribes, to go against Sisera and also Jabin and so forth. And we find these are the tribes and the places where they were from. Deborah sends for Barak, son of Benoam. Jehovah has commanded to go to Tabor, Mount Tabor, with 10,000 men to fight against Sisera, captain of Jabin's army. I, Jehovah, will deliver him into your hand, is what Deborah told Barak. And so Deborah says she will, he said he would go, but only if, what? Only if she would go with him. You know, normally a man stands up and leads the way, right? Yeah. Not this time. Barak said, I won't go unless you go, Deborah. And Deborah said that I'll go, but here's going to be the problem. Jehovah's going to give honor to a woman because of the winning of this battle. So they went together to battle against Sisera. And the area of the battle was in that area right there. That's where Mount Tabor is actually at. So Sisera, learned that the Israelites had gathered for war, and he took his chariots and soldiers to the river Kishon, and that's that river I was telling you about that runs from Mount Carmel all the way down to the Jordan. And so Deborah tells Barak, go forth. Sisera will be delivered into your hands. So Barak took his army, then went down from Mount Tabor down to the valley, headed down, and this was a day that there was evidently a lot of rain. We've had a lot of that lately. But the river Kishon swept away many of the chariots. Not the iron ones, but a lot of the other ones that it swept away. And so the others, because they were iron, they couldn't go. They probably got stuck in the mud. They couldn't go up the mountain to Mount Tabor. There's Mount Tabor. It's a pretty good sized little spot of ground up there. But if you think about it, up here is where Barak and his men, 10,000 of them, and they were coming down towards the Jezreel Valley. And that's this valley down through here. But in time of a lot of rain, you have Kishon River that flows down through there, and in the process of that, you had a lot of the chariots that were getting stuck, and they just became useless, you might say. Normally, they'd take chariots. I've heard at times past that they would actually even put swords on the wheels, and they just run through an army, just mow them down, you might say. Now, whether they had that or not, I couldn't say for sure, but I've heard that was what took place sometimes. So Sisera, realizing that he couldn't go, evidently, so he jumped from his chariot and ran. And Barak and his men pursued Sisera. Sisera's men fled north to Harosheth Goan. Anyway, and Sisera himself actually ran to the east towards Kadesh Naphtali. There's Harosheth Goan in that area, and there is where Kadesh Naphtali is. That's where Sisera actually headed for. So he was abandoning his army and running the other direction, you might say. He ran to the tent of Heber, the Kenite. Now, we've already talked about the Kenites before, and they were whose relatives? Moses' relatives, that's right. Okay, and Judges 1 reminds us that who that actually is. Sisera asked Jael, was her name, asked her for some water because he had been fleeing from Barak, and Jael and her husband evidently were kind of had a close relationship evidently with Sisera at this time. I'm going to have to hustle up. So anyway, he laid down. She gave him some milk instead of water. I remember A.J. Rollins said she gave him warm milk. Warm milk will just make you just sleep right on, won't it? And that may or may not have been warm milk, I'm not sure. But anyway, he lay down, she covered him, and he went soundly to sleep. And while he was asleep, Jael actually took a tent pin, drove it through the temple of his head and into the ground and killed him there. Later, Barak and his men came looking for him, and she said, "He's in my tent." And so they entered and found him. And just as Deborah had said, the honor went to a woman for the victory. God brought Jabin and the Canaanites under control and were finally destroyed by the Israelites. This may have been the first series of battles, but anyway, regardless of what it is, they were destroyed. And Deborah writes a song in chapter 5. And now we have the judges, and they are Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah. All awake? Jer. It's just about as slow as y'all are. Ibzan, Elon, Abdon, Samson, Eli, and Samuel. All right. Very good. Okay. That's it for tonight. Bell, first bell's rung. Thank you for your participation tonight.